They were mostly men who worked outside and ranged in color from swarthy to lobster red. She remembered none as milk white as Douglas, who had an office job in the government and didn't get out much into the sun. Douglas St. Pierre's school chum was tall like him and slender. The two men embraced at the front door with a lot of helloing and harumphing while they shook hands, a secretive gesture that looked like they were rummaging in each other's pockets. The school chum's wife stood behind him in the doorway and looked at the men sweetly, not seeming to mind that they ignored her completely. Suddenly recollecting her duties, she too was watching the men's ritual handshake. Alexis crossed toward the wife, grasped her elbow, and relieved her of her coat. It had been arranged that Johnny May would follow Alexis unobtrusively and take the guests' coats as Alexis handed them to her. Johnny May managed to haul the two guests' coats into the anteroom, where she'd been directed to place them on the chaise. The wife's was a full-length mink coat, as dark as coffee and more silky than anything Johnny May had ever felt. Hearing a gentle clacking of pans in the kitchen and the excited tittering of Alexis in the parlor, Johnny May knew she had at least a split second to leap onto the coat and burrow her face down into it. "Better leave that alone and see if your mother needs help," he said gently, quietly. The word stung Johnny May like a slap. Her cheeks became warm with shame, as if she actually had been slapped. How could she have let herself get caught by Douglas St. Pierre doing such a babyish thing? He stood in the doorway, betraying no amusement, as Johnny May smoothed the rumpled coat and her own clothes, then slipped past him out the door. If she had known the language of Douglas St. Pierre's moods and expressions, she would have known he was amused at her antic, as he was often amused at the foibles of women. Johnny May was little different in his eyes from Alexis. To him, females could hardly help the silliness of their nature, little matter their age or color. By 3 p.m., Douglas St. Pierre had poured so many glasses of wine that Alexis's head was light. At 3:05, Johnny May was sent into the parlor to whisper to Alexis discreetly that the roles would be compromised if dinner was delayed much longer. At 3:45, dinner was served. The dining table was anchored at one end by a large ham that was scored, stuck with cloves, and drizzled with syrup. At the other end was the large roast turkey with stuffing. Alexis wanted the table to be groaning. Douglas's school chum must see how well things were for him. So there was enough food on the table for 10 people. The two slim men and the two slender women were dwarfed by the array of dishes: candied sweets, mashed white potatoes, tiny green peas, corn pudding, stewed tomatoes, cranberry sauce, and yeast rolls. In the kitchen, Mama fixed two biscuits with sausages and put two cups of coffee at the edge of the kitchen table. She pushed a sandwich toward Johnny May. "Don't spoil your dinner," she commanded her, knowing she was surely hungry with the working and the smells of the food. Alice was anxious not to spoil the Thanksgiving dinner with Willie and Ina and all of them around the table. The big holidays, the feasting holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter, these were the times when she missed her papa's house in Carolina. Alexis St. Pierre thought she had a table groaning. That woman had never seen the table of a man who loves to hunt, who has three sons and three daughters and a wife younger than himself, and a few milk cows and hogs and chickens and bursting sacks of cornmeal and a cupboard full of preserves and pickles and head cheese. Johnny May and her mother left Alexis's house when all the dishes, except for the dessert things, were washed and put away. Alexis St. Pierre left her guests, still eating the Martha Washington cake, and came into the kitchen. She insisted that Alice take the ham, as well as the leftover rolls and cakes and pies. Why, there was still more than half of a Virginia ham. As they headed down Wisconsin Avenue, Johnny Mae trailed her mother, pulling the loaded wagon. At P Street, Mama stopped in the middle of the cobblestone street for a moment and looked down into Johnny Mae's face. She took the girl's hands, put her fingertips against her lips lightly, and kissed them. Alice stood a moment and enjoyed the smell of food and bleach on her daughter's soft fingers. Johnny Mae's fingers were still soft despite doing grown-ups' work. They were still a child's hands. But not a baby's. No longer a baby's hands. Lord, no. She stood a moment, mourning for the baby child who was fast going away, and then thinking herself a silly woman to moon about a child who won't stay a baby. The only way for a baby to stay a baby is to die. And each day of a child's life marks the death of the day before, a day the mother mourns. Releasing Johnny Mae's hand and falling into step beside her, Alice continued down to O Street. She felt an oddness down in her vitals, some kind of a fluttering feeling. She was thinking about the coming child, and she felt ashamed of herself in Johnny Mae's presence. She felt a little ashamed that having Johnny Mae might not be enough. Alice paused for a moment on the top step of their house. Exhausted, she reached down to catch a second wind. She called out to Willie and Ina as she and Johnny Mae came through the door. Ina's intentions were as pure as daylight. Alice knew that, and Alice knew that she couldn't possibly have managed to have a Thanksgiving dinner for her own family and cook and serve for the St. Pierres if it hadn't been for Ina. But coming into her kitchen and seeing Ina bustling about, basting the turkey and turning out biscuits onto a pan for baking, gave her a small, unhappy feeling. This feeling was so small and spiteful that it didn't have a name. And in a good person's soul, it wouldn't last very long or do much damage. It was the small feeling that had to do with not quite knowing who she was in her own kitchen. Ina moved aside quickly, handed Alice an apron, and exclaimed over the extras Alice and Johnny Mae had brought from the St. Pierre's. This act, this giving back to the wife and mother control of her own domain, was thought by Ina and not disputed by any of the other Southern women to be her due. If the colored woman couldn't claim much of her own in the world abroad, at least her kitchen was her legally sanctioned bailiwick. Here she was the boss, and no other person, no daughter or sister or cousin or man, could cut her hair in this precinct. She determined the measures and the portions. She was the chooser. She gave the most succulent piece of chicken to the husband or the child, determining which piece of the meat which person got. Willie, because he liked the leg and thigh, got the fat, plump pieces rather than the other ones ever so slightly drier because they had stayed in the pan too long. The driest pieces Alice put aside for herself out of the widely held notion that the cook accepted responsibility for all mistakes. She was the one who gave Johnny Mae the breast that was the size she could eat, rather than the one slightly larger that would turn off her appetite. Cracking the wing pieces apart and separating them for Clara, because Clara hated to rip them apart, but loved only the tender, sweet wing meat. She carried the portions and preferences in her head, and as strict as it sometimes was, it was also thrilling control. She said which and how much for them and for herself, and always retained the power to give herself less. She, the loving, dutiful mother, could account for every meal her two children had eaten, and every meal her husband had had since he married her. And the limits of her energy and the skill and resourcefulness and cleverness of her buying and cooking for them, and for Alexis and Douglas St. Pierre, determined how they would be fed. "Take those clothes off and lie down a few minutes. I'll call you when dinner's ready," Mama said, for she could see that Johnny Mae was more worn out than hungry. A little nap would give her a second wind. Papa sat listening to the radio with his ear up close and his face turned away from the women as they crisscrossed the room, putting dishes on the table. He'd done his part by setting up the table in the front room, and now he was sulking about the late dinner. The last few days he'd argued that their working for the St. Pierre's on Thanksgiving Day made a comment about him that he didn't like. People would think he didn't give a thing to keep his family, that his wife and daughter had to work on Thanksgiving Day, cooking in someone else's kitchen. A family woman, a woman with a husband and children, should be able to pass up a day's work on Thanksgiving Day. On a day like that, a woman ought to be in her own kitchen. Alice had answered him again and again that she was doing it as much as a favor as anything else. Douglas St. Pierre was having his important friend from Harvard College, and Ms. St. Pierre couldn't take a chance on hiring out a stranger. Alexis had appealed to her like a friend or neighbor. That part galled Willie. Alice was letting Alexis St. Pierre put a claim on her for friendship. A whiff of Clara's fragrance, a sweet yeastiness, struck Alice like a glimpse of the girl as she walked the candied sweets to the table. Their color was the color Clara's stomach had been early on when Alice had wrapped her. All the day's smells had been so bounteous. Since early, since just at sunrise, Johnny May had been inhaling the odors of cooking food. The richness and the complex mingling of sweets and sours and pungents had been absorbed under her skin. Now the food heaped on her plate made her feel like gagging. "You eating your dinner, Johnny?" her father said in his plaintive inquisitiveness. "All this food and nobody got an appetite." "What are you talking about, Willie? We eating as hard as we can," Ina said. "Johnny May is just pecking. She must have ate up at Miss St. Pierre." "We didn't eat up at Miss St. Pierre," Mama said, rolling a swallow of water in her mouth. "We saved ourselves to eat dinner at home." "Couldn't work all day and not eat. Sitting on the side in the white folks' kitchen like a backyard child? This girl ain't no backyard child. This child ain't no backyard child. I'm raising her. I'm feeding her, ain't I?" "I wanted us all to eat together," Mama said quietly, trying to deflect a fuss. "Now what you hollering about, man? This is Thanksgiving. We all sitting here together eating our dinner. What you hollering about?" Ina said. "Alice, you raising this child like you're doing it alone. I got something to say about working in the woman's kitchen on a holiday. If she care about her husband's friend, why can't she cook her own dinner?" "Now, Willie, you know Miss St. Pierre can't manage a big dinner for people," Alice answered him sweetly, hoping to edge him away from his annoyance. "Why can't she? Why can't she do it?" "Oh, don't talk silly. You know they don't know a thing about working hard enough to do all that," Ina countered. "All she knows is to wring as much out of a colored woman as she can." "Oh, don't let it worry you and spoil your dinner. She'll pay for her easy life. There'll be less heaven for her, that's all. And she'll be sorry she spent this short lifetime without toiling when she sees the half measure she's gonna get in heaven. I intend to be there with my feet up and my head on a downy pillow. Much work as I've done in this life, and you too." Ina averted the strife handily, and all of them finished the dinner, laughing and easy. Chapter 13. Still somewhat reticent with adults, Pearl was not in January the scared rabbit she had been in September. She walked briskly out of the classroom and threaded her way into the crowded hall before Johnny May could catch up to her. For the first time that Johnny May could recall, Pearl Miller was walking purposefully, ahead instead of measling along behind her or standing still. What kind of bug did she have in her drawers? Johnny May noticed that Pearl's eyes were now on level with hers. She was holding her chin up and not ducking her head. Pearl Miller seemed to have developed a new, curvy body. The knobs on Pearl's chest had blossomed, and she now wore a brassiere. Pearl Miller was becoming a new person. Johnny May's breasts were still little more than nubbins, but they had become more noticeable. Neither her mother nor her Aunt Ina had discussed it with her, but they decided between them that Ida must now get to work on a brassiere for Johnny May. It was no longer appropriate for her to be going around wearing undershirts like a boy or a baby child, her nubbins bobbing around for anyone to see. She was coming on to be a woman. Mama said that everybody matures at her own pace, and every girl gets her monthly and develops a bosom. It's just a matter of time. Mama was brusque in her way of talking about these woman things. According to her, some subjects aren't worthy of a whole lot of ruminating. The things that make a woman didn't bear much conversation. Only a slattern would fill her days running off at the mouth about what's up underneath people's clothes. A decent woman had too many other things to do with her time. All she said that morning before school was that Aunt Ina had something for her to try on. So Johnny May must come home right after school let out. The thing was simply made of white cotton and delicate eyelet lace on the straps and cups. It was small, and even with it on, her breasts made hardly a ripple on her blouse. Aunt Ina saw the bit of disappointment on Johnny May's face when she looked at herself. "Just give it time," Aunt Ina said. "Don't try to hurry up to be a woman. You're going to have to be one for the rest of your life." To Johnny May, time seemed to be having its own sweet way with her. Here was Pearl Miller, who used to be a sack of potatoes and a scared rabbit to boot, now looking like a grown woman, and her chest still looked like a boy's. Johnny May came straight through to the kitchen. Mama stood at the stove with her back to it. Johnny May stared at her mama's stomach. She saw the rounding and couldn't believe how foolish she'd been not to have seen it sooner. How could she not have noticed something so obvious? Her own mother, someone she saw every day, looked unfamiliar. Mama's face was puffy along the cheeks, and her waist was completely gone. Now that Pearl had pointed it out, she could see it clearly. Pearl had said matter-of-factly, "Your mama's having a baby, isn't she?" Johnny May had been struck dumb at the idea. No one had told her a thing. Now she put her hand tentatively on her mother's stomach. The belly was thick and tight. She was shocked, not only at the obvious swelling there, but that her mother allowed her to touch it. Johnny May took her hand off, back to the other side of the table, and looked at her mother's stomach from across the room. Mama seemed to her to be standing way far off on the other side of a valley. She was visible, but removed a distance from Johnny May. Mama's words, too, seemed to be straining across a chasm. "I'm going to have a baby, Johnny May." Johnny May looked at her mother's face, then quickly down at the floor. "Don't act a baby, Johnny," her mother said. "You're a woman yourself, nearly. It's natural for us to bring another child. It'll add to our joy." Mama's words were strange, not unintelligible, just unfamiliar. Yet there was a familiarity. The conversation had gone like so many of their talks. Mama said Johnny May was a woman, but she spoke to her, as always, as if she were a child. Despite her mother's smooth, calm delivery, there was an undercurrent to her words. Was Mama frightened? If it was the state of natural circumstance for a woman to be in the family way, then why was she trembling a bit, sucking in her bottom lip? When Papa came into the kitchen, Johnny May and her mother were on separate sides of the room. Again, there was a shift, a realignment of the tectonic plates of the family ground. The earth beneath them was shifting, and they would be moved by it, as they'd been moved by the death of Clara. They would be a different grouping with a new baby. Would it be a boy? They always say a man wants a boy. How would Papa feel about her after he'd gotten his boy? Johnny May wanted desperately to be grown up. She wanted to have a glorious bosom and the calm, smug womanliness that everybody said would come to her one day. But she was scared that even though she wanted to move away from these people, this new baby might knock her completely out of their lives. Chapter 14. Never take advice. Can't keep still all day. And not being a pussycat, I don't like to doze by the fire. I like adventures, and I am going to find some. Johnny May began Chapter 5 of Little Women with her elbows flat, her shoulders hunched, and her chin resting on the kitchen table. Dinner and dishes were over, and the family, Mama, Papa, Aunt Ina, and Johnny May, were sharing each other's breaths in the kitchen before bedtime. The women passed the time sewing up holes in socks. Papa sat back in his chair, working a toothpick in his teeth. Warmly School had few books other than the hand-me-down texts given to the colored schools by the school board. Miss Clementine Chichester, the librarian at the Mount Zion Church Community Center, had highly recommended Little Women to Johnny May. Miss Chichester, a college-educated woman who did laundry for very rich families, took it as her mission to disabuse colored people of the notion that the only fit book for them and their children to read was the Bible. Georgetown's alley residents were her biggest constituency, and she considered it her calling to promote health, hygiene, and education in those precincts. A codger and an irrepressible social reformer, Miss Chichester visited the homes of wealthy Georgetowners on her laundry rounds and hauled off any unwanted books to build up the center's lending library. Miss Chichester was impressed with Johnny May's reading ability and urged her to borrow a copy of Little Women, with the caveat that the book must not be put down in a pan of gravy, that her hands must be washed before opening it, and that Towser must not be allowed to chew on it. She praised it, promised Johnny May that she would enjoy it, and that upon her signature in the record book, it could be kept for a full 2 weeks. Alice's and Ina's talk around the stove was full of the doings and goings-on of Ms. St. Pierre and Ms. Mary Ann Clark. Johnny May drew down into the book and let their voices play above her head. She fancied herself like Jo, a girl with too much moxie to sit around chattering about other people's business. When folks talk about a person talking up a blue streak, they usually mean somebody like Miss Mary Ann Clark. Ina's best customer, she was a tall, angular woman who talked constantly while having her fittings in the front parlor. Miss Mary Ann Clark talked so hard and fast that she hardly seemed to be breathing. The stream of words flowed endlessly outward. Never mind if someone thought to answer her. Answering wasn't at all necessary when Miss Mary Ann Clark talked. Ina told Alice what Miss Mary Ann Clark had said about the St. Pierres being in financial trouble. Earlier that afternoon, Ina had cleared her throat and drawn her lips tighter around the row of straight pins in her mouth as she pinned the hem of Miss Mary Ann Clark's new black serge skirt. Seated on a small hassock, she removed each pin from her lips, slid it into the fabric, and leaned back to get perspective on the work. Miss Mary Ann Clark stood on a slightly taller hassock. Ina's front parlor floor was an obstacle course of hassocks. The four square wooden stools with legs at graduated heights and plush upholstered centers like nougats were used for measuring and pinning customers' hems. Cap had made the stools, and Ina had fitted them with cushions at around the same time she decided to put a seamstress sign in her front window on Volta Place. My sister said that woman, Alexis St. Pierre, has been taking her family's silver service down to the Jews on M Street. Miss Marianne Clark said, they say her husband is tied up in some bad business about money down at the agency where he works. My sister says he has run through all their money. How come you don't take in laundry, Ina May? You can make a pretty penny if you did laundry and pressing along with your sewing. As it is, I've got to send my things down to the Chinaman on Water Street. Ina's mind had wandered, and she was sorry she hadn't caught more of what Miss Mary Ann Clark was saying about the St. Pierres. But a body would lose her mind if she tried to keep up listening to this talkative woman. Removing the last of the straight pins from her mouth, Ina had replied, Miss Mary Ann Clark, you know I don't do laundry. I never have. That about the length you want it now? Glancing in the mirror, Miss Mary Ann Clark had answered, Yes, Ina May, that will probably do. If a decent woman like you took in some laundry, we wouldn't have to deal with Chinamen. Always prepared to sew, Ina now pulled another sock with a hole at the heel from her running bag. She took a needle from the place above her heart, where several threaded needles were worked through the dress, and set to work on the sock. According to Alice, Alexis St. Pierre had been acting nervous lately. She seemed especially nervous when her husband was at home. It was as if she were guarding herself against saying something to him. For his part, Douglas St. Pierre appeared to be avoiding his wife. When both were in the house, there was little conversation, and the only time there was lively talk now was when Douglas St. Pierre entertained his acquaintances. Alexis was fluttery and irritable on these occasions, and became increasingly so as the talk turned to investments and speculation in the stock market. Douglas became downright giddy then and took on a child's delight in tales of wild speculation on the stock market. Alexis would look at him with a dull, puzzled face and refuse to join in the gaiety. As a senior clerk at the Department of the Treasury, Douglas St. Pierre afforded a comfortable, though not opulent, lifestyle. The backbone of the St. Pierre's financial position was Alexis's inheritance. When the women's talk wound down, Willie rose, stretched, and went out to the toilet for his evening constitutional. Johnny May closed her book and hurried to wash up near the kitchen stove before going upstairs to her chilly bedroom. At the St. Pierre's house the next day, Alice counted Alexis's silver pieces and found many missing. Miss Mary Ann Clark was right. They had been selling off their belongings. This was coming at a bad time. With the baby coming, Alice had wanted to work right up until the baby came and then have Ina work in her place until she could take her job back. But if the St. Pierre's money was getting tight, then soon they wouldn't be able to afford to keep her on. Better be asking people if they've heard of anything. Alice ruminated on the St. Pierre's and their financial troubles while she worked. All she was going to learn, she'd have to learn at the keyhole. Though they'd had a respectful camaraderie over the years, Alice knew that Alexis wouldn't discuss her troubles. Alexis would consider it unseemly to talk about these troubles straight out and honestly. Around the time that dinner was ready and Alice prepared to serve it, she heard Alexis and Douglas arguing in the parlor. When they moved into the dining room, she could hear their conversation clearly from the kitchen. She was embarrassed for them at first. Then she got angry that they were not ashamed to air all their business within earshot. She listened quietly, seated at the kitchen table with her hands folded as if praying. Douglas St. Pierre spoke to his wife in a low, sullen, growling voice. Alexis's voice danced above his in a tearful, high-pitched whine. How can they do that? How can they do it? Douglas, how can this happen? Alexis's words were clearly intelligible. Alice was unable to discern Douglas's reply. She could only hear his growl. Alice decided not to go into the room. There wouldn't be any way to pretend that she wasn't aware of their argument. The sound of a door slamming followed. Alice waited impatiently in the kitchen. The argument seemed to have run out with the slamming door. The next noise from the room was Alexis's crying. Alice was in a tangle about what to do. She wanted to get the dinner served and get home, but she was reluctant to go into the room. Her annoyance grew into anger while she waited the dinner. She fussed to herself that she had better be looking for something else if they were going to start acting like this. She didn't want foolishness. Around 8 o'clock, Johnny May came to the back door of the St. Pierre's house and looked through the kitchen window at her mother. Mama was sitting at the table with her arms folded across her chest and her face as tight as Dick's hat band. The family had been waiting for her, and Papa had sent Johnny May to see if there was trouble. At the sight of Johnny May, Alice rose from the table, signaled to the girl to wait, and marched into the dining room. Alexis sat alone at the table, staring at the place settings. Alice quietly informed Alexis that she had put up the food and was going home. Alexis said nothing, but tears ran down her cheeks. She sat at the table looking at the chair her husband was accustomed to sit in and continued crying. He was not there, but she looked as if she were hanging on to every word that came from the empty chair. Alice left the St. Pierre house feeling angry. When she'd gone a block, she thought to be ashamed of herself. She was mad at Alexis and Douglas. But she hadn't stopped to feel sorry for Alexis crying into her sleeve like that. He'd made her cry. He'd fussed at her and lied to her, most likely, and done something that caused her to cry. And Alice was only feeling sorry now that she'd left their house. Up underneath them in the house, her compassion was squashed by annoyance with them. And this annoyance had crowded out her better feelings. Wintertime brings a closed-in feeling that creates hazards and annoyances. Households draw in toward their centers for warmth in cold weather, and emotions and conflicts that are dispersed in balmier air keep circulating and threatening to strangle folks when they're inside so long, huddled against the cold. In the house with them, Alice hadn't given Alexis as much sympathy as you'd give a dog. But out in the sharp air, she could hear the woman sobbing and wished she'd given her some show of feeling. Alice walked down Wisconsin Avenue feeling grateful that Willie had sent Johnny May to see about her. She had a feeling that she wanted to gather up her loved ones and crush them to her. Then her mind went to Clara, the fact of her being gone, and a twinge passed over her. Alice's thoughts raced ahead to the coming child, and she wondered if every joyful thought would now be diminished a jot by longing for Clara. Johnny May skipped down the street ahead of her mother. When Alice caught up with her at the street corner, Johnny May was staring into the large pit that was the construction site of the new Francis Junior High School swimming pool. Johnny May stood under a streetlight with a dreamy look on her face. After much agitation on the part of Reverend Jenkins of Mount Zion Church and Reverend Souter from the First Baptist Church, and Reverend Walker from Jerusalem Baptist, and Dr. Tyler and Miss Elizabeth Boston, and Miss Clementine Chichester and others, the District of Columbia had finally agreed to build a regulation swimming pool for colored children in Georgetown. The churchmen had organized the most prominent of Georgetown's colored people to press the district government and the Congress to recognize that colored citizens were paying taxes. And being taxpayers, they were entitled to recreational facilities and libraries for their children. The leaders cited business after business in Georgetown owned by colored citizens who paid their taxes as certainly as their white neighbors. Hundreds of signatures were gathered on the petitions, and the pastors made the rounds of countless meetings. Building the Francis Junior High School swimming pool was a compromise, though. The government was immovable, and the white citizens were adamant that the same playgrounds, pools, and libraries not be used by both colored and white. And as long as there was something for everybody, nobody could squawk. Though there was something like progress about the pool, there was something else, too. They had built a pool for the colored children. Colored weren't allowed into the whites' only pool on Volta Place and never would be. That was final. The swimming pool had become the biggest topic of conversation in Georgetown. People wrote to their people back home about it. Little as it was, the colored folks had got something for themselves. To Alice Bynum, the new swimming pool was tangible proof that their opportunities were better in Georgetown. "As long as we're making progress," she said to herself, "no matter how slow, as long as we're not standing stock still with our shoes in the mud." An odd thought came to her as she stood back a bit, watching Johnny May. She tried to think back to when she'd begun thinking of progress and better times and accomplishments as something for Johnny May rather than for herself. After all, she was not an old woman. But comes a time for a woman when she stops thinking of herself as a girl, as a person of possibles. She starts looking at the plain facts of herself. Her body that's become the body that she has, and her habits becoming the habits that she's written in stone. Her haves being the one she's got and maybe not getting any more. Alice knew she was still able to work hard, was still a clear thinker, was still pretty enough. But there had recently come about a transference. She had come to a kind of resignation that real progress was not going to come in time for her to really latch on to it. Johnny May would get it. Johnny May would be coming around just in time for the brass ring. And what there was chiefly for Alice and Willie to do was to make sure Johnny May was ready. They would prepare her, be sure she'd be able to reach for it. Johnny May must be able to finish school, must go all the way through. Maybe she'd go on after high school to a college. Maybe she would find work as a teacher or a nurse. Alice's dreams took on an ever-rising spiral. Johnny May would perhaps be a school teacher, and a big woman like Miss Nanny Helen Burroughs or Miss Mary McLeod Bethune or some other Negro women. That's why Alice and Willie worked, why they'd come to Georgetown, and now there was the baby to dream for, and they needed to keep their children from being ground down by want so much that they wouldn't be able to dream dreams for themselves. She and Willie could have filled their bellies and shod their feet in Carolina, but for schooling and dreaming, their children were better off here. Yes, it had happened. She had ceded the future to her children. Johnny May's dreams fetched closer to hand. She had been watching and waiting for the swimming pool to be completed. Each day since the work had begun, she'd looked down into the hole that was fast becoming a trench that would eventually be lined with tiles and by June would be filled with water. Nobody was more excited about the new pool than Johnny May, and nobody more eager to jump in. Chapter 15. Come on, was what Johnny May said to Pearl that afternoon after classes let out. It was a January day with bright sunshine and soft clouds. The phrase that had always rallied Clara to her cause, whatever it might be, had the same effect on Pearl. At first, she'd just stood there. Johnny May walked away a few steps, looked back at Pearl still standing on the steps of Warmley School, raised her eyebrows in a way that questioned the girl's moxie, and walked down Prospect Street. Pearl followed. Johnny May was right to call Pearl a scaredy cat. She was scared a lot of the time. Since the Millers' troubles out in Oklahoma, Pearl had started to be skittish and to shrink away from people. But she couldn't stop herself from following Johnny May either. Johnny May had said, "Come on," and she couldn't disengage herself from the pull of the girl and make any kind of firm decision to stay put. So she followed along. The blessed freedom of walking in and around the clusters of people, buying or selling or toting a load, buoyed the girls. "Step on a crack, break your mother's back." Johnny May looked like a ballerina or an aerialist, walking from cobblestone to cobblestone, not stepping on the cracks, placing her feet on one rounded stone, then another. She held her arms out away from her sides to balance, and Pearl tried vainly to copy her. Johnny May scuttled away from the crowds of folks on Wisconsin Avenue and wound her way up and around and through alleys. She went past Stevens Fish Market in order to see Pearl's eyes pop. She knew that the sight of the huge sword tail hanging in the window would make Pearl gape like Clara used to. They took the alley behind the fish market and down toward Water Street. A group of men with bloody aprons sat on crates gutting fish. "Watch out!" Johnny May called to Pearl, not stopping, only skirting the men. Pails of wastewater cascaded out of doorways all along the street, running over the cobblestones and sluicing toward the river. Johnny May followed beside this septic freshet to the nasty tangle of wild growth and human waste at the river's edge. They followed along a pathway that was merely a ribbon of bare ground pounded out by numerous feet. Pearl got winded and was breathing out of her mouth like Clara used to. Once, Johnny May pulled up and turned around to face her with arms akimbo and chest stuck out. Pearl bumped smack into her because she had her eyes on the ground. Pearl took the blow and stopped and looked at Johnny May with alarm. Johnny May didn't say anything, only stamped her foot. Pearl wondered if this meant she was to turn around and go back, but when Johnny May resumed walking, she continued too. The path was filled with mud puddles and rocks of all sizes. Some of the rocks were sharp-edged, and some smooth and slippery. Every kind of stick and board with splinters was calling, "Step on me, I dare you!" And some whipsaw shrubs lashed their ankles. Despite the cold and the even chillier breeze blowing in off the water, Johnny May peeled open her coat, perspiring with the exertion of cutting through debris. Pearl, struggling mightily to keep up the pace, was nevertheless chilled to the bone. She held together the place at the waist of her coat where a missing button left her abdomen exposed, and her gloveless right hand developed a white crust. She lubricated her lips with saliva in the face of the river wind, lashing them, and the wind quickly seized this moisture and dried her lips still more. By the time they reached the end of Water Street and continued down under the Francis Scott Key Bridge, both their faces were tight and ashy. The brambles became ever wilder as they continued westward. The two, with Johnny May leading, sidled past the Washington Canoe Club, a cozy clapboard structure perched on the riverbank with a fancy dock attached and stacks of canoes on two sides. Members only, and no trespassing signs sprouted here and there on the periphery of the club's property, and an irascible hound patrolled the fence to keep the hoi polloi to the public side of the path. "That's the three sisters, those rocks out there. That's the top of their castle. That's where Clara is. But you know that 'cause that's where you came from." Johnny May pronounced all this as if there could be no doubt as to its veracity. People in Georgetown had always spoken of the three sisters as if it were both an identifiable trio of female spirits and a place in space and time. It was there, and it was them. It was near, and yet not at all near to the bank. All that was between the three boulders and the shoreline on either side for a span of perhaps a mile was the mysterious bailiwick of the female spirits who inhabited the Potomac. Pearl had never been so close to the edge of the river. She could never have imagined herself at a point so close to the boulders. She shook her head briskly, as if she meant to dislodge her confusion, and struggled to figure out why Johnny May was so convinced that she was a part of her sister's drowning. How in the world had she gotten hold of this idea? Suddenly, Johnny May ran up the embankment, away from the river, turned on her heels, and ran fast back down toward the river's edge. Pearl expected that she would stop at the lip of the river, that this was some version of a game of whirligig. But Johnny May continued into the river up to her waist, soaking her shoes and socks and most of her clothing. Pearl backed away from this spectacle, afraid that she would be pulled into the frigid water by Johnny May, or by some force at work to grab young girls. For the first time, she started to believe that some power could be at work around the banks of the Potomac. She wanted to beg Johnny May to come out of the water, to just come out and let them go on home and never come back down here. But she didn't know how to get it said. Often, she got plain disgusted with herself for not being able to say out loud what was struggling to get said. It was at these moments, and there were so many of them in a day, that she would shake her head from side to side. So many moments required this head-clearing motion that it was fast becoming a mannerism of the girl. She blurted out, "You pushed your sister in the river. You're mean, and you didn't love her, and you pushed her down in the river and made her drown." The words stopped Johnny May's whirling. This was the most she had ever heard Pearl Miller utter. And this string of words was nothing less than a quiver of arrows fired straight at her. This was the test of her theory that Pearl Miller was in some way Clara come again. Because if Pearl Miller knew what actually happened, if she knew things about the events at the riverbank, then it was certain proof that she was some sort of haint. The trouble was that Johnny May herself hardly knew what had happened. The girls were swimming, cannonading, swimming in circles around each other. Johnny May was pearl diving. Clara was sitting on the back end of a log, and there was a big splash, and Johnny May thought it was her own body slicing the water. But it had been Rat. Rat had hit the water with a big splash. Rat and the log. And Rat had never come up again. And she never saw her again. Never saw Rat alive again. She had bobbed up to the surface of the water and didn't see Clara. Clara sitting on the log on the bank was a marker, a place on the shore that placed the swimmers, that showed where they were in the water. Then Clara was gone from the log. Johnny May looked and counted the other heads above the surface of the water. They were all there giggling and laughing, but not Clara. Johnny May dived down below. She opened her eyes to see beneath the water. Everything was green and cloudy. She couldn't see a thing beneath the surface. She came back for air. She sucked in air and dived back down. Her chest was on fire. She couldn't see Clara when she came back to the surface. She saw the white ribbon that was on Clara's plait, that she had tied to Clara's plait. She thought momentarily to be angry that the white ribbon was off the plait and floating and going green in the slimy water when it should have been fastened to Clara's hair. She went down again and forgot to close her mouth. Water came in her throat and through her nose. She duck-dived to retrieve Rat, but Rat never came back to the surface until she was dragged up by the men from the city. Johnny May hadn't actually seen it, of course. She hadn't even been told about this. Her mama and papa hadn't thought it was appropriate to tell her how Clara's body had come up out of the river and been prepared for burial. Snow Simpson, his skin was dark and glossy like a ripe eggplant, was mad about being always called Snow. One day, for meanness, because Johnny May had not let him have one of her pencils, Snow Simpson had told her all about the men pulling Clara from the Potomac. He sidled up to her ear in the schoolyard and said that the men from the city had come up and stood around and had dragged lines in the water and had finally snagged Clara like a big old carp and hooked her and reeled her in and started to throw her back for being too small. This last he'd said over his shoulder, gliding past, smirking. And Johnny May had hit him in the back so hard, the bones in his back stung her hand. At the river now, the cool water coursed through her legs, sloshing her labia, chilling them, and causing a shiver. Warm urine let go and streamed down and warmed the labia. The cool water was less cool, then cooler again. The coolness called her back to herself, and the freezing cold water slapped her out of her reverie. She barreled out of the river, out of the water. The freezing water seemed to burn her skin. Mad at herself for peeing on herself like a baby, she ran up the embankment to Pearl and pushed the girl's chest. I didn't push nobody. I didn't push Rat. You must have pushed her like you're pushing me. Pearl Miller heard a girl yelling and could feel her heart in her ribcage fluttering. Standing toe-to-toe with Johnny May, she had a sensation of floating. She could hear a lot of angry talking, and she could see that Johnny May's lips had ceased to move. And so she concluded that the girl yelling into Johnny May's face must be herself. She felt a thing taking hold of her, trapped as she was with the river ahead of her and her feet mired in all kinds of debris on the riverbank. And Georgetown was up the slope, and people were walking by on their own business, and not many of them even noticed her. And Johnny May, the only person who seemed to take a notice of her, was badgering her about being a haint and seeming to threaten her with drowning. Was Johnny May pulling her out to the Three Sisters, offering her in exchange for Clara? Or maybe she was just working in concert with these mystery forces in the river that wanted to pull down somebody foolish enough to come out here, someone who could never match her curiosity with enough courage to take any daring action. I didn't push Rat, Johnny May said it loud. She said it hard. She was telling herself more than she was telling anybody. Her soul was leaping with happiness that someone had challenged her on the point. Somebody was so mad, so involved with this tangle, that they'd confronted her and asked her if she was responsible. And now she could insist and hear herself say it. No. She had not pushed her sister. She did not drown her sister. She did not even realize until too late that she had lapsed in her caring for her sister and let the Three Sisters, the Potomac, or whomever take her away. There was her mother, herself, and her baby sister. And on a day when she had the care of her sister, a day when she chewed down on her mother's responsibilities, she had failed. She'd been trusted as she'd always been trusted, with Clara. She had failed. She had been a little mother countless times. It was her duty. Who's Rat? Pearl asked in a pleading tone. My sister, Johnny May answered, exasperated with Pearl's pretending not to know about Rat. You call your sister Rat? How your mama let you call her a name like that? She doesn't know it. She doesn't have to know everything. They don't have to know everything. Eventually, they find it out. She don't have to know. She's gonna know you've been up to something. Your clothes are all wet. Shut up. It's none of your business, scaredy cat. You're scared of your own shadow, just like Rat. You're scared of everything. Being a scaredy cat draws trouble like a magnet. Being scared draws a mad dog to you like a magnet. The angry petulance that had Johnny May in a tangle with Pearl was familiar. Often she had been so angry with Clara. The scaredy cats were always standing back with their hands folded meekly, hoping to grab fun on the go. They were always hoping to pick up what fun and adventure somebody else would make. They could pick it up like lumps of coal falling from the back of a coal truck. They got their fun and adventure by accident. Johnny May wanted to make the fun, make the adventure, pull something down into her lap. The girl stood there on the embankment with arms folded across their chests, mad at each other. Johnny May felt wet and stinky. The river water and her own urine had made her clothes a mess. Pearl was right. Her mother would notice and would demand to know where she'd been and what she'd been doing. They'd better leave right away. She'd better get back to the house and change and rinse out these things and make up some story about it. "Come on, scaredy cat," she said, turning her back on Pearl, who was still facing toward the three sisters. Over her shoulder, she flung a threat. "If you tell, I'll put my foot in your butt." Chapter 16. Alice, Ina, Miss Iola Perryman, Miss Hattie Miller, Miss Elizabeth Boston, and Miss Clementine Chichester boarded the streetcar at Wisconsin Avenue and P Street in a fluttery state of excitement to travel to Union Station to meet Miss Gladys Perryman's train. Gladys Perryman, the niece by marriage of Miss Iola Perryman, was arriving from New York to settle with her aunt and uncle in Georgetown. Miss Iola's endless bragging at church about her husband's brother's girl, who was attending Madam C.J. Walker's School for Beauty Culture in New York City, had whipped up anticipation of her arrival. According to Ms. Iola, Georgetown was getting a true artiste of the hot comb. Here was someone who'd surely raise the standards of taste among the tasteful women. Miss Iola gathered up an eager committee of women and girls to meet Gladys's train at Union Station. Johnny May thought the whole thing was a silly waste of time. Mama insisted upon dressing up in her Sunday things, and Johnny May was made to dress up too. Aunt Ina, who had been going on and on about Miss Gladys Perryman, insisted upon going to the station to meet her. She said she'd invite Miss Perryman to join their Penny Savers Club, and Mama said she thought Miss Perryman might hold herself a bit above such activities. Riding downtown on the bus and walking through the streets with Mama and Aunt Ina and Ms. Iola Perryman and the other ladies, Johnny May slunk back a bit. She tried to lean into a place of shadow created by her mama's body, standing against the outside world of Washington. She knew she was too big a girl for this. She knew that this feeling belonged to a time when she was a much younger child and had walked through the streets or ridden on a bus with her parents. When they ventured out into the larger Washington City world, some inexplicable thing, a force or something, was out there that Papa and Mama and Aunt Ina had to buffer against. Their faces and torsos anxiously breasted a tide of strange looks and behaviors. The thing was amorphous, was an ill-defined, unsure feeling that the adults had when they left Georgetown. Mama was always fussy about their clothes and hair when they got aboard a streetcar. Several times on this trip, Johnny May brushed off the front of her dress and smoothed her hair. Mama had insisted that Johnny May ask if Pearl could go along. Upon hearing of the outing, Hattie Miller included herself. Like Johnny May, Pearl was acting sullen on the bus trip to the station. Perhaps the white people seemed so numerous in Washington City because the colored people